1, the opening verses, Solomon has a warning for us. He tells us to anticipate the storm. Anticipate the coming storm. Look at verse 1, and this is the familiar verse that we all know, at least we know the first half of it. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. I've heard that verse as long as I can remember. You've heard that verse a long time as well, but that's probably about as far as we normally go with it, right? But that's not where the verse ends. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. But what's the rest of it, right? Before the evil days come and the years draw nigh when you say, I have no pleasure in them. Evil days here doesn't mean, it's not indicative of moral evil as though we turn bad. It's used of times of hardship. It's used of difficulties, tragedies, calamities that we face. Remember your Creator now because it only gets harder. And inevitably, there are some hard times coming, some evil days coming just by virtue of the fact that we're turning pages on the calendar. I don't know if we sing the song here. We sang it where I grew up. Swiftly we're turning. I know that that's the name of the song. Swiftly we're turning life's daily pages. Swiftly the hours are changing to years. I found this to be interesting. I don't know who came up with it. I don't know how they did the math, and I'm not going to dissect it. But I thought it was interesting. I'll share it with you just for what it's worth. If you were to, you know, compact life into a 24-hour period, like a clock, you know, running from midnight to midnight, and all of your life is tucked into that 24-hour period. If you're 35 years old, it is 2:59 p.m. P.m., not a.m., p.m. If you are 40, and you can read this, you find your age on it, do you see where you are? If you're 60, this will be Blake Ham, it is 10:11. And then Alan, if you're 70 plus. Isn't that kind of discouraging? Whoever did this clock, I think, because I tell you the truth, they didn't say 70 plus. All my original notes said was if you're 70, midnight is approaching. I thought, well, to be fair, if by reason of strength 80, you know, and I thought, I don't want to discourage. Well, I'm 85. I don't know. 70 plus, midnight is approaching. So with that in mind, though, Solomon says, you need to anticipate the storm. You know, look at verse 2. Do this before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds, look at this verse, I'd never noticed this, and the clouds return after the rain. I think that's interesting. That's the verse you just read over and think, okay, and the clouds return after the rain. But you would think it said, and the clouds are gone after the rain. You know, it's rained and now the clouds move out. That's not what he says. He says the clouds return. You know, you've been somewhere and you've seen a dark rain cloud approach and it's ominous and foreboding in the sky, just opens up, pours down rain. Cars have to pull off the side of the road. Your windshield wipers can't go quickly enough to keep it all off. You know, and then the storm passes though. But have you ever seen that and then you look out on the horizon and you see another storm approaching? There's more clouds in the distance. Solomon says, don't you realize? Solomon says, don't be so foolish, you know, to think that your life is any different. There's a storm that's brewing. Remember now your Creator before the days come, before the time draws nigh when you say things aren't as good as it used to be. Because the older you get, right, and I don't have to tell you that, there'll be more physical challenges. The longer you're here, just by virtue of the fact the longer you're here, there's more opportunities for things to go wrong. Now, look at verses 3 through 7. This was the handout. Solomon paints a very vivid picture of growing old and what he's talking about when he says those evil days come and the years draw nigh. I got this birthday card from, it says your favorite Bama fan, but that's a misnomer because I don't have any favorite Bama fans, so that's not correct. That's not correct. And then it says Roll Tide Ken as well. And so I know this is from the Butlers. And I noticed just it's in the same handwriting. I mean, you know, Ken didn't write anything. It's not in crayon. So I know it's Mary Helen. I know it's Mary Helen. But the card said, you know you're getting older when, dot, dot, dot. You know you're getting older when. And it says, everything hurts, and what doesn't hurt doesn't work. You feel like the morning after, and you didn't go anywhere the night before. This is one. This one is hitting home to me. Your knees buckle and your belt won't. That hurts. Leah came up to me today. Sweet little Leah, you know. We can always count on Leah. You know, Leah to be sweet, you know. And Leah gives me a hug and she says, Dad, I can't even get my arms around you. You're very fat. And I, thanks for that, Leah, you know. You can only burn the midnight oil until 9 o'clock, and then the twinkle in your eyes is the sun hitting your bifocals. Well, I saw, when you look at verses 3 through 7, this is what Solomon is saying. And you can refer to your handout because we won't look at all of them. But he says in Ecclesiastes 12:3, the keepers of the house tremble. These will be like the guards or maybe the groundskeepers. They're the last ones that you think, you know, would tremble. And the analogy here is probably to our arms and legs. You know, just not as strong. Your arms and legs are not as strong as they once were. It is said that men after the age of 25, will lose 1% of their lean muscle mass, their lean muscle tissue, every year. 25, 1% every year. Just by aging. You know, sometimes you don't feel that for 10, 15, 20 years, but then you wake up one morning and you go, hey, you know, I'm not 25 anymore. I'd like to feel 25 again. So fairly early in life, and that's what he's getting us to think about, fairly early in life, you start seeing signs, you know, that you're just not like you used to be. He says the grinders cease because they are few. That's most likely there, the teeth. You don't have as many teeth. I took a class at UAB. It was called The Biology of Aging. And it was one of the toughest classes I had, not because the material, but the way the teacher tested it. She tested it. It was ridiculous. But anyway, She said this, and this is what I remember. She said, it's important to keep your teeth if you can keep your teeth. She said, you know why it's important to... And I'm from Piedmont, so I'm like, nobody keeps their teeth. But I did think, why is that? She said, you know, you lose your teeth, she said, and people then start eating if they don't have dentures. What do they stop? What can they not chew anymore if you don't have teeth? She said you lose out on a lot of protein, and then they're eating Jell-O or they're eating, you know, their broth or whatever. And she said it is detrimental to their health, right? She said it's important to keep your teeth. Look at what he says next. Those who look out the windows are dimmed. Now, what do you think that's a reference to, obviously? When the sound of the grinding is low, there's some difference here. Some say that's another reference to your teeth. The teeth are few. I think it probably means the hearing is impaired. It talks about the sound of the grinding is low. Maybe you can't hear as well as you once did. Once you arise at the voice of a bird. Can any of you relate to that? You don't sleep like you used to. Everything becomes more difficult, and even getting a good night's sleep is a hard thing to do. When I was a boy, I think that I could sleep through a tornado. Could sleep through anything. And then you get older and you wake up more easily. And all the daughters of music shall be brought low. daughters of song, some virgins have. It's more difficult to have a happy moment. My grandparents, in their later years, moved from Trustville back to Piedmont, and they lived in what we called the old folks' apartments. They had some apartments in Piedmont. I don't know what they were called, but we called it the old folks' apartments. It was a term of endearment. At any rate, there was a sign. When I would go visit them, there would be a sign as you pulled into the old folks' apartments, and it said, what did it say? No skateboarding, no bicycles, no loud music. And I remember thinking, they ought to have just plucked that sign up and put no fun zone. You are entering a no fun zone. We don't have time for all of that. Don't come out here and think you're going to smile at the old folks' apartments. We don't have time for smiles. If you're having fun, go have it elsewhere. They got parks for that, whippersnappers. But Solomon is saying that these coming days are inevitable. The storm clouds are gathering. Look at verse 5. They are also afraid of what is high, and terrors are in the way. You're afraid to get up on a little step stool. Why? Because you could fall. Terrors are in the way. Afraid of tripping, afraid of falling. Did you know that 70% of older people who fall and break their hip will die within a year? Are older people afraid of falling? They certainly are. Terror is in the way. Look at the B part of the verse. The almond tree shall blossom. These blossoms are white. It's indicating the hair is changing color. On and on he goes. But the idea is, if you travel down this road and you live a normal life expectancy, the road becomes hard to travel and it ends up in death. And so Solomon says, I want you to reflect on this now. Remember now your Creator, because mark it on the calendar, he says, from this day forward, it just gets harder. I remember someone in the yearbook, their senior quote was something to the effect, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Well, Solomon says, remember your Creator now, because from this day forward, it just gets more difficult. And you say, okay, Solomon, now that you've got me all cheered up, right, what do you have to offer? What do you have to say? What is your counsel? He says, this gives you perspective, because so many people are living in a dream world. They're in fantasy land, like things just get easier. Like standing before God in judgment is just going to be a walk in the park and you just tell Him how it is. They live like it just gets easier from here on out. Solomon says that's not wise. That's not smart. He says, will you reflect on this? Will you think about this wisdom? But then he says this, if you'll reflect on this and you'll be serious about it, then you can do this. What? He says you can respond to this wisdom because it makes sense. Keep a finger there and turn to 1 Samuel. Solomon's plan of action is found in the very first words of Ecclesiastes 12 when he says, remember your Creator. Whether young or old, that is such a vital point. But the question then is, well, what does he mean? What does Solomon mean when he says, remember your Creator? I wanted to look back this Old Testament example. You remember Hannah? You remember Hannah? She was childless and she wanted a son so very badly. And she's pouring out her heart to the Lord in the temple. She's praying. Her lips are moving. She's not saying anything. And Eli, the priest, sees her and thinks that she's drunk. I'm not drunk. I'm pouring out my soul to the Lord. But look at verse 19. Who will read 1 Samuel 1:19? That's what I wanted. Look at the last part that Alan read. And Jehovah remembered Hannah, remembered her. You know, does that mean God said, oh yeah, I know her, I remember her, I've seen her in the temple before? No, what's it mean? Right? It means that when God remembered her, He took action, right? And Samuel was born. Well, just so when we're told to remember our Creator, it's more than just, oh yes, I recognize God created the universe. It means to take action based on what you know about God. Who made it possible for you to eat today, right? Who made it possible for you to breathe today? To borrow the words of Jesus, who sent the rain and the sunshine on you today? Don't forget that. What a valuable bit of advice that is. Don't wake up and forget God. Don't wake up and forget your Creator. Who sent His Son to die for you? Who did that? Remember, that's what He's saying. What did Jesus say that you and I need to do every first day of the week? Remember me, He said. Don't go on living your life like your Creator doesn't matter. No matter how stormy it gets outside, He says, remember your Creator. No matter how hard things may be. Look down to verse 11. Go back to Ecclesiastes 12. No matter what is going on, never forget what God has done for you. That's what that means. That's what that means. Someone please read Ecclesiastes 12:11. All right, look at that. The words of the wise are like goads. What is a goad? Not a goat. Not a goat with a T, but a goad. What do you do with a goad? Yeah, Ben said. You prod something, right? You poke it, you press on it, you get it to go. Well, these goads are to get us moving. And then he says, like nails firmly fixed. In other words, hang this truth on your wall. Remember your Creator. Now, look at verse 13. We're ready to notice Solomon's grand conclusion, which really, if you think about it, has been the lens through which we've interpreted this entire book. This entire book. He says, I like how the ESV has it here. The end of the matter, all has been heard. I said all that, he said, to say this. Let us hear the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. Some versions have duty there. I think the ESV does. And here's a drawback. I love the ESV. You didn't know that, did you? But a drawback to the ESV. The King James here has the word duty, doesn't it? This is the whole duty of man. But you'll notice something about the word duty, won't you? What is it? It's italicized. You know what it means? When, you know, if we italicize something today, it means we're emphasizing it. That's not what it means when you read that in the King James. It was inserted. It was inserted by the translators because they felt like it gave the sense of what the writer was saying. Sometimes those are helpful, and sometimes they're not needful. I don't think it's as needful in this case. But a drawback to the ESV, if you're using it, is they don't italicize. They don't show you. I don't know why they're trying to save on the typeset. I don't know what the reason was. But I want to know if something's inserted. And the ESV doesn't do that. Maybe they'll do that in future versions, but they don't here. In other words, you could take out the word, fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole of man. This is what it's all about. When everything is said and done, you fear God, you obey Him. Well, why fear God? Why fear God? Well, for one thing, because of all that He's done for you. But here's another reason to fear God. Fear God because of judgment. Fear God because of judgment. Look at verse 14. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether it is good or evil. I underlined in my notes the word secret. And my mind immediately goes, you know, to the negative. He says every secret thing, whether good or evil. Some secret may be good. You know, I think about what Jesus said, you know, when you give alms, don't let one hand know what the other hand is doing. Don't be like the hypocrites that blow the trumpet to sound what they're doing in the streets. Do these things in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Or Jesus said that when you have a feast, don't invite your rich neighbors, but invite the poor, the lame, the halt, the blind. And He says you'll be recompensed. You'll be recompensed at the resurrection of the just. And so there may be secret things that no one knows about but God, and He's going to reward you because you did well, right? You did good. But then He says every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. Make a note here, and you may have if you have a cross-reference Bible. Does anybody have a note here to Romans 2:16? Does it have a little note? Let's turn there. Because when you read this, and it's very similar to what Paul says in Romans 2. Look down to verse 16. Who has Romans 2:16? All right. God is going to judge the secrets of men. And we see who the final judge is, don't we? Who's our judge on judgment day? Jesus Christ. Something to remind ourselves of. And that's, we know, sometimes someone says, well, God doesn't know what I've been through. How can He empathize and understand? Well, Jesus was a man, wasn't He? The Word became flesh, John 1:14. And what's interesting is if you look at John chapter 5 and look, verse 17, look at 26, 27. Jesus is going to judge us as the Son of Man. Jesus said, He has given Him, the Father has given Me authority as a Son of Man. Is Jesus God right now? He is. Jesus has always been God and will always be God. Is Jesus a man now, too? Is He? Not flesh and blood. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:50, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. So Jesus right now is not flesh and blood and bones and, you know, but does Jesus retain His identification with humanity? That's what I'm asking. What do you say? He does. He does. You ought to mark 1 Timothy 2, verse 5. 1 Timothy 2, 5. We're familiar with verse 4, and your God would have all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. For there is one God, there is one mediator between God and man. And then what's it say next? Does anyone know? Himself man. Himself the man, Christ Jesus. I've circled man in 1 Timothy 2:5 in my Bible. 1 Timothy was written in 63 AD or so, right? So Jesus had been ascended back to heaven for 30 years. At this point, hadn't He? 30 years. But He says, Himself man. If that doesn't mean that Jesus, and I can't explain that, how Jesus retains His humanity and yet not His flesh and blood, and yet there's one sense in which I can, because when we go to heaven, we'll go as we were here on earth, not our flesh and blood and bones, but still you, right? Your humanity. And so Jesus retains His humanity. What did Stephen say? And you know that's what, I know this is a brief rabbit, but we got time. You know what Son of God, we always talk about Son of God, and it becomes so easy for us to say Jesus is the Son of God. What's that mean? Because I always wondered growing up, I didn't doubt Jesus was the Son of God, but I wondered, why do I have to confess that Jesus is the Son of God? I mean, God said to, indeed, that's all I understand. But why? What is so important about me understanding Jesus is the Son of God? Why is that so crucial? And I think sometimes we're so far removed from first century times that we don't pay attention to maybe how they used language. Right? Do you remember in Acts chapter 7? Do you remember what when Barnabas sold that piece of land and then he took the money and brought it and laid it at the apostles' feet? Do you remember what name they gave him? Right, his name was Joseph. They named him Barnabas, which means what? Son of consolation, King James. Son of encouragement. Well, to the Hebrew mind, that's an idiom. That's a way they used language, a figure of speech. Someone who was the son of consolation or the son of encouragement, that's someone who partakes of the nature of an encourager. You're the son of encouragement. That's just their way of saying, you sure are good at encouraging. Do you remember when Elymas the sorcerer tried to withstand Paul when Paul and Barnabas were teaching the gospel to the proconsul, and then Elymas tried to withstand what they were saying, and Paul said, you son of the devil. Remember that? Son of the devil. You're partaking of the characteristics in opposing God's word. You're partaking of the nature of the devil. When Jesus prayed in John 17, wasn't it? I have kept all that you have given me. None of them is lost except for who? He didn't say Judas. What did he call him? The son of perdition. The son of destruction. Same thing over in Thessalonians, where the falling away, that day will not come until the falling away comes first and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. So it's the same. So what does it mean? Son of consolation, you're someone who encourages. Son of the child of the devil, well, you got that. Well, what does it mean when Jesus said, I am the Son of God? What's that really mean when you get down to it? What's it mean? He's God. When Hebrew ears, and we're so far removed from it, it just becomes a title to us. Oh, Jesus, Son of God. What's that mean? It means He's God. Right? When they saw Him, I am the Son of God. Well, obviously, the Son of God would partake of the characteristics of His Father. He's God. But, and I think 45 times in the New Testament, you read Jesus described as the Son of God. But almost twice that, Jesus' favorite description of Himself wasn't Son of God, although He occasionally used it. What was Jesus' favorite description of Himself? Son of Man. What's Son of Man mean? I'm a man. I'm a human, right? And if you read John 5, we read Jesus is going to judge us as the Son of Man. Look at Acts 7:56. Right, Jesus has ascended. Stephen was stoned, the first Christian martyr, and he looked up to heaven, and what did he say? I see the heavens opened, and who did he see standing on the right hand of God? What did he say? He didn't say Jesus, though, did he? The Son of Man. I see the Son of Man standing. And so the question I ask, let me say this. Acts 7:56, is Jesus the Son of Man right now? Yes. I see the heavens open and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God. 1 Timothy 2:5, there's one mediator, Himself man, Christ Jesus. Is Jesus a man today, right now? He is. He is. Flesh and blood? No. Human? Yes. Is He God? Yes. He can't be anything other, right? He's always God. And if you look at Acts 9, verse 20, you'll see that. Saul goes into Damascus, and what does he preach? Acts 9, verse 20, that Jesus what? Is the Son of God. Not was, is. Right? Is Jesus God? Yes. Is Jesus man? Yes. And He'll always be man. I think that's one thing many members of the church don't consider. They picture Him. Jesus was pure spirit God before He came to earth. Came to earth, spirit joined flesh, the Word became flesh. And they picture Him as He goes back to heaven and now He's pure spirit again. He's pure spirit again, but he's not. He's not. He still retains an identification with us. Look at Hebrews 2:11. Does anybody know what it says? That's an unfair question, isn't it? Who knows what Habakkuk 2:18 says? Hebrews 2:11. And I'll make a point here, I promise. Hebrews 2:11 says, and he says before this, both he that sanctifieth and they that are sanctified are all of one. He that sanctifieth is Jesus. They who are sanctified is us, are all of one. As the antecedent is understood, they're all of one nature. Not that we're God, that's not the point under consideration here, but that Jesus is man. That's the point under consideration. But if you look at verse 11, for which cause he what? He is not ashamed to call them brothers. Circle the word is, it's present tense, tonight, 2015. Was Jesus your brother before he came to earth? He was not. What was Jesus before he came to earth? In the beginning was the Word, John 1:1. The Word was with God. The Word was God. He was the Word, pure 100% deity state, pure spirit being. He took on flesh, John 1:14. He wasn't your brother until he became the Son of Man. He became the Son of Man. He became our brother. But it wasn't just those 33 years. It's forever. Isn't that amazing? Jesus said, I love you people so much, I'm going to stay identified with you forever. So that is he God? He's God. But is he man? He's man. Isn't that amazing? And that whole thing, nobody can say on Judgment Day, you don't understand what we've been through. He does. Tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. And at the same time, that is not just a negative point. He understands what we've been through because he's human. Jesus, isn't it interesting that the Son is our judge? Could the Father not function in that capacity? I'm sure he could. Of course he could. The Holy Spirit, not our judge on Judgment Day. The Son of Man. The Son of Man is your judge. Romans 2:16. You know, that ought to get us moving. And that ought to keep us moving. Remember your Creator. God is going to make a decision. And when I say God, I'm talking obviously about the Son. He's going to make a decision about your sincerity. He's going to make a decision about your motives. It's not enough to do the right thing. We have to do the right thing for the right reason. God's going to make a decision about our effort or lack thereof. That's why you need to think about it. And I need to think about who God is and what God has said. And you know, we're going to be in judgment individually, Romans 14:12. It won't be enough to say, well, God, I was a member of the Jacksonville congregation, and don't you know the many wonderful works that we did? What did I do? What did I do? I can't ride the coattails of my congregation, right? What did I do? Let me say this. We've got, what, 5 minutes? Is that right? 10? I don't know. I don't think I even need 10. Let me ask you this. What is the most physically painful experience that you've ever had? Maybe a broken bone. Maybe you've been in a car accident and had some serious injuries. They say kidney stones is just about as close to dying as you can get without doing it. And I believe it. What's the sickest you've ever been? The flu? That can be bad. A lot of people die from influenza every year. You feel like you just can't breathe. Maybe you've been sick recovering from surgery or recovering from treatment, right? Chemotherapy. What's your most embarrassing experience? Have you ever been embarrassed in public? Have you ever been embarrassed at work? Have you ever been humiliated because of sin? You know what my most embarrassing experience is? I'm not going to tell you. Right? Because I don't want to relive it. Who wants to relive that kind of thing over and over again? But when have you been hurt the most? Have you ever been falsely accused? Ever had someone just maliciously tell a lie about you to try to discredit your character? How about this? When your kids were smaller, were you ever out somewhere and your child was lost? That's a sick feeling. You know, it goes from, oh, hey, where is that kid? You know, it goes from that to all of a sudden, where are they? 5 minutes can seem like 5 hours looking for a child, knowing all the crazies that are out there. Well, have you ever had that experience? Are there ever people, think about this, How would it feel if that initial fear response that you had, thinking your kids, you know, what if that turned into reality? Are there people who have actually had their children taken away? Can you imagine what those people go through? You talk about pain. Physical pain doesn't even come close. Or what about betrayal? What about when people turn on you in such a way that it hurts you to the very core of your being? What about the brother in Christ in another state who found his wife, caught his wife in the act of adultery? What kind of betrayal is that? What kind of pain is that? It's severe. But whatever your most painful experience is, I want you to think about that. Whatever the sickest you've ever been, I want you to think about it. Whatever your most embarrassing moment might be, whenever you've been hurt, whatever you regret the most, just take a moment and think about it. And I ask you this question. What if all of those things, what if all of those things were going on at the same time? Imagine a woman who's experiencing, you know, perhaps the most physically painful thing that a woman will ever experience in giving birth to her child. She's having a very difficult labor. And at that moment, at the moment, that painful labor, she learns that her parents have been murdered. And at that very moment, the doctor has to tell her, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but your child is stillborn." Right? Your child has died. And that her husband, at the same time she learns, her husband is carrying on an affair. He's committing adultery. And that all the sins that she has ever committed, anything and everything that's ever humiliated her, have been published in the newspaper and are on the front page. And all of this at once. All of those horrible things at once. And then she learns that that moment, that one moment where she learns those awful things, that one moment is going to be frozen and it's going to go on forever. Now, if there's any way to get our minds around what it would be like to be eternally lost, you just think about that. Because that doesn't come close. That doesn't come close to standing before God and hearing Jesus say, "Depart from me. I don't know who you've become. I don't know you. I don't recognize you." No hypothetical scenario of physical or emotional pain that we create can compare with being lost, because God has deemed, because God has decided, He has judged that we're not faithful. That's what Solomon is saying, right? Solomon says that ought to get you to thinking to never forget what God has done for you. Never disregard who He is. Listen to what He said. Submit to what He said. So when life gets hard and life gets difficult, and He's told us that it is, when doubts and fears and perplexities arise, He says, you just hang on to what God has said. Believing in God and doing what He said, that's the only way that we can live a life of hope. Hope of going to heaven. You know, and as horrible as it is to think about being lost, we can't create any kind of scenario that would describe to us how wonderful it is to be saved. But Solomon says that's the key to living. Focus on God, who He is, and what He said. If we'll do that, everything else will be in the proper perspective. Because what we all, nothing else matters, ultimately, what we all want to hear from the Lord is this: well done. It's been hard. It was hard, but well done. Good and faithful servant. Isn't that what you want to hear? I sure do. Let's encourage each other. Let's exhort each other to always fear God and keep His commandments. This really is the sum of the matter. I hope our little journey through Ecclesiastes was profitable for you. I hope you're able to glean something maybe as we went over these chapters. What I would like to do, I know our gospel meeting will start Sunday, and so next Wednesday, Todd Clifford will be preaching to us. Lord willing, the next Wednesday, I would like to start a little series, probably about the same length as this, on the book of Job. I once did a report, you probably couldn't do this today, when I was in high school, I did a report on Job, and the kids had to give feedback afterwards, and they thought the whole time I was saying Job, J-O-E. Like, oh, Job, boy, he went through some rough stuff. And I'm like, well, that will be Job. So we're not reading the book of Job. We're going to read the book of Job. And I'm looking forward to that. But I thank you again for being here tonight.